Live from the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences at Michigan State University, it is now time to go beyond the X's and the O's with WKAR's current sports.
You want to go after an athlete, one of my athletes, come after me. I'm a man. I'm 40.
My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get.
Yes, did I express to them I was mad? I was furious. Just furious.
I know my wife will at least shut fake one time.
We're talking about practice, not a game.
And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Looking in the mirror. But I look good. I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cat.
Here's your host, L. Martin.
What's up, current sports listeners? Happy Friday to you. It is Friday, July 6th, and I'm here in Studio S on Michigan State's campus. And this is Current Sports, coming to you from WKAR, AM 870, or 105.1 FM. You can also listen online at WKAR.org, or go to my Facebook page, and I have the live stream up and running for you. Lots to talk about on today's show. We'll be bringing you some MSU updates as far as the Larry Nassar case is concerned and some of the responses that MSU has taken and to try and make up for that. We'll also talk NHL. Interesting, are there super teams such as the ones in the NBA now developing in the NHL? I'll talk with current sports production assistant Jack Kerwin about that later on in the show. And then finally, to end the show and to end the week, we'll do Reflection Friday for you. Again, a lot to talk about today, multiple ways in which you can be part of the show. Tweet me directly at Ian Hawley WKAR, or tweet the show at WKAR_sports, and we'll do our best to respond to your comments there. You can also comment on the live stream on Facebook, on my Facebook page. And again, one of our current sports production assistants will do their best to get to those. Call into the show, 517-355-9527. Is the number to call if you'd like to give some comments on any of the things that we're talking about here today. But again, a lot to get to today. You know what comes first. Here are your current sports quick hit headliners. It's Jalen Watts Jackson back in the news, but not for football this time. On October 17th, 2015, Jalen Watts Jackson etched his name forever in Spartan football history with that famous play. The freshman defensive back scooped up a mishandled punt and sprinted 38 yards to glory to give the Spartans a 27-23 walk-off win over Michigan and keep Michigan State in the college football playoff race. Watts Jackson suffered a broken hip in the ensuing celebration, and while his legend will never die at MSU, his football career would never be the same. He announced in March his intention to become a graduate transfer, and he will now join the Air Force, according to SpartanNation.com. No, not to play in the Air Force Academy's football program, the actual Air Force. His transition from Spartan hero to American hero is admirable and further cements the already immense legacy that Jalen Watts Jackson has left at Michigan State University. So fantastic news for Jalen Watts Jackson. Congratulations. He will now be a member of our esteemed Air Force. Investigators from the U.S. Department of Education scheduled interviews on MSU's campus in April and May for 40 university employees as part of its investigation into the university's handling of sexual assault complaints against Larry Nassar. Investigators also wanted to interview 8 former Michigan State University employees, according to documents the Lansing State Journal obtained through a public records request. Interviews were part of an investigation by the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, which handles Title IX issues. The office launched its query in February after Nassar was sentenced on 10 counts of sexual assault. The investigation is ongoing, but it's unclear if all 48 of the current and former officials were interviewed. Spokespeople for both MSU and the Department of Education declined to comment on the matter. A Michigan State University law school professor was named as the acting chief compliance officer at MSU yesterday. The position is new, created as a part of the school's attempt to reform itself following the Larry Nassar scandal. Interim President John Engler appointed Nicholas Whitner, a professor of law in residence at the MSU College of Law, to the position. And we'll have more on that in just a little bit. In their second game without manager Ron Gardenhire, the Detroit Tigers showed some positive signs despite losing to the Texas Rangers 7-5. Gardenhire left the game Wednesday afternoon with heat exhaustion and was advised by the doctors to sit out yesterday's game as well. Things did not look good for Matthew Boyd as he gave up 6 earned runs in 4 innings. However, the bullpen was strong with 5 scoreless one-hit innings to give the Tigers offense a chance. And they took advantage of that. They fought tooth and nail, scoring 5 runs in the last few innings, and even threatened to tie it up before unfortunately taking the L. The Old English D now falls to 38-51 on the season. Crazy to think that just a month ago they were on the verge of 500 and catching up to the AL Central leading Cleveland Indians. Just before the start of the Las Vegas Summer League and the first glimpse of the team under the new coaching staff, the Pistons continue to assemble their front office staff. The Pistons have hired Greg Polinsky as director of player personnel, a league source confirmed to the Detroit News yesterday. ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski first reported in the hiring. In his new role with the Pistons, Polinsky will oversee the scouting department, and report to senior advisor Ed Stefanski. The two worked together previously with the Brooklyn Nets. Polinsky started with the Nets as a scout in 1999 and was promoted to director of scouting 5 years later and has been the director of player personnel for the Nets ever since. He's regarded for his ability to gauge European talent especially. In a turnaround from last summer's contentious negotiations, the Detroit Red Wings and Andreas Athanasiou avoided even the threat of arbitration. Darren Ferris, Athanasiou's agent, told the Free Press yesterday that the sides have agreed to a contract. The deal is for 2 years with a $3 million annual salary cap hit. Athanasiou, 23, made $1,387,000 last season. He produced 16 goals and 17 assists in 71 games for the Wings. He had a .46 points per game average and 15 minutes per game, and compared to a .45 points per game average and 13.5 minutes per game average in 2016-2017. Athanasiou was a restricted free agent with arbitration rights. He had until Thursday to file. A year ago, Athanasiou and the Wings did not reach a deal until after the regular season started. Athanasiou finally joined the Wings on October 24th and played his first game on October 26th. So good news there for the Red Wings as they re-sign Andreas Athanasiou to a new 2-year deal. Today marks the beginning of the quarterfinals in the World Cup as France took on Uruguay this morning. Goals from Raphael Varane and Antoine Griezmann, combined with beautiful goaltending from Tottenham Spurs goaltender Hugo Lloris, helped France reach their 6th semifinals appearance. Later today, Brazil takes on Belgium, and that's scheduled for around 2 p.m. Tomorrow at 10 a.m., Sweden takes on England. Both of their last World Cup matches have resulted in a draw, but both were during the round-robin stage of the tournament. Home team Russia faces off against Croatia at 2 p.m. tomorrow. The last five host nations to feature in a World Cup quarterfinal have all made it to the semis, including Italy in 1990, France in 98, South Korea in 2002, Germany in 2006, who actually ended up winning that World Cup, and Brazil in 2014. Those are your current sports quick hit headliners. If you want to call in and share your thoughts on any of those, just give us a call. 517-355-WKAR is the number to call. Again, that's 517-355-9527. I'm going to get my act together here, people. It's Friday. It's been a long week, but we're so close to the weekend. Again, you can go to our Twitter page, WKAR_sports, and tweet one of our fantastic production assistants there. And you can also go to my Facebook page where the live stream is up and running and leave me a comment. I'll do my best to check those and get back to you during today's show. Lots to talk about. Let's get started. All right, people, let's start in the world of Michigan State University, specifically the news that they have named a new chief compliance officer. Michigan State University has named a new chief compliance officer, Nicholas Whitner, and WKAR's Scott Pohl has a report for you.
Nicholas Whitner, a professor of law in residence at the MSU College of Law, was appointed by Interim President John Engler to lead the Office of Enterprise Risk Management, Ethics, and Compliance. In that role, Whitner will promote an ethical culture and legal compliance on campus. Whitner has an undergraduate degree from MSU and a law degree from Wayne State University. He previously spent 20 years with Nissan's legal department and also served as a trustee of St. Joseph Health System of California. He will report directly to the president and through the new Committee on Audit, Risk, and Compliance to the MSU Board of Trustees. The appointment takes effect immediately. Scott Pohl, WKAR News.
And I have a quote from John Engler in a statement that he released yesterday. He says, quote, "Professor Whitner's deep background in legal, regulatory, and policy compliance makes him the right person to set up our new office and develop the necessary reporting and training protocols. We are both deeply committed to making MSU a model for regulatory compliance and for organizational accountability." End quote. The position reports to the president and includes regular independent reporting to the Board of Trustees, as Scott just said. Thank you, Scott, for that report. The office comes as a reaction to the Nassar and William Strample scandals, where multiple people knew about complaints regarding sexually inappropriate behavior, but never briefed board members. And again, if you don't know by now, Larry Nassar is the former MSU doctor accused of molesting more than 200 women under the guise of medical treatment, and William Strample, his boss and former dean of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine, is facing four criminal charges. They include using his position to, quote, harass, discriminate, demean, sexually proposition, and sexually assault female students, according to court documents. Former MSU President Luana Simon has acknowledged she knew in 2014 of an investigation into an MSU doctor who had been cleared, but has said she didn't know the details of Nassard's decades of assault. Engler continued by saying the person will be in charge of seeing red flags. He said there were flags that should have been caught in the Nassar case, including not having records for what Nassar said were medical treatments and a court said was sexual abuse. Quote, that could have come up. You're checking to make sure the checkers are doing their jobs. Our internal auditors might flag something, and this office will keep track of who is following up to make sure it's resolved. The position won't replace compliance officers already in place across the campus, but will instead add yet another person to help grow a new culture on campus, Engler said. Michigan State's compliance officer will be charged with, among other matters, the development and implementation of a model program for promoting an ethical culture and legal compliance, including high-quality training and ensuring employees' understanding of their compliance responsibilities, oversight of a confidential reporting structure for known or suspected violations of law or policy, and assuring the investigation, tracking, and resolution of such complaints. So I like this move from Michigan State and this specific hire with Nicholas Whitner. Whitner has MSU ties, so he'll hopefully make sure the university is getting back on track and put more organizational structures in place to ensure the Nassar scandal doesn't happen again. It's good to have another avenue to report problems through, and good that this position will independently report to the Board of Trustees and to the president separately. However, I still think the structure needs work at the lowest levels. This is a good step for MSU, but the problems obviously started a lot lower on the totem pole than the chief compliance officer level of the administration. While they may have been prolonged by people higher up in the MSU staff, the problems started when coaches and fellow staff members either failed to say anything or failed to notice the wrongs being done in the first place. I think coaches and teachers should be required to have yearly meetings with this new officer or the officer's staff to ensure proper etiquette and proper treatment of students and athletes. I also think there should be mandatory meetings for members of the medical staff, and space and time should be provided each semester for athletes to meet with compliance staff to discuss how they've been treated by coaches and trainers. And again, the semester, we can do it once a week if we really need to make students feel comfortable. I mean, really, it's up to the students and the athletes to say whether they feel comfortable rather than the university to say, oh yeah, everything's fine. So I think there should be a time and a space set aside for those students and athletes specifically to meet with the compliance staff. If MSU really wants a long-term fix to this problem, measures like these will have to be taken to ensure there is no failure to report by teachers or trainers and coaches. Jack Kerwin is on the board today in my usual spot as engineer. Jack, how do you feel about this? And as a current student at MSU, how close do you think the administration is to kind of correcting the systematic flaws, at least?
You know what? I'm hopeful, Ian. I'm hopeful. You know what? I like the hire. I feel like so much of what's being done, you know, especially from the Board of Trustees, unfortunately, has been for a while pretty tone deaf. And I think more recently they've kind of come out and tried to show some support for, you know, the survivors of sexual assault here at MSU. But moving forward, I don't have a whole lot more to give you other than I'm hopeful. I don't know a ton about the gentleman we've hired. I saw David Harn's report on it yesterday, and I read a little bit into it. But, you know, I'm skeptical. I've been skeptical, and until, you know, a new president that isn't John Engler, and I've my understanding is about a year from now we'll announce our new non-interim president. You know, I'm just kind of skeptical up until that point.
There's been a lot of criticism of the board and of John Engler specifically of being insensitive to some of the victims, and rightly so. I mean, it was alleged by one student that John Engler actually offered her money in exchange to keep quiet about the traumas that she had faced. But this is a step in the right direction. I mean, it doesn't fix the insensitivities of the board, But at least now, like you say, Jack, they're being a little bit mindful of where they are and where they stand in the MSU community and the steps that need to be taken in order to correct this serious issue. And like I say before, I do think this will benefit the students. It's a new avenue for reporting to be done, and I like the fact that it's independent of most of the other offices and will report to the president and to the board of trustees separately. Kind of a separation of powers there, and it will ensure accountability for not only the board of trustees and the president, but also for the rest of the staff. I mean, it's kind of absurd to me that there wasn't a position like this in place before, but I guess they say better late than never. It's frustrating that we are still having to talk about this on MSU's campus in relation to John Engler and the Board of Trustees. It's frustrating for a lot of students that a step like this has taken so long, and I still don't think the student body is quite satisfied with the way the Board of Trustees and John Engler have been handling things here at MSU. In talking with fellow students, in talking with teachers, and in talking with other members of the community, you know, even in Lansing and beyond, there's a lot of scrutiny and a lot of blame to be placed on the Board of Trustees, but also, again, on the staff members who failed to report on this in the first place. And that's why I think that some of these extra steps are now necessary in making sure that this position does not just become another placeholder on the MSU staff, or does not just become another PR move for the university. I think that coaches specifically and trainers should be held to a much higher standard than they've been held to in the past at MSU. And there needs to be a lot more documentation as to what's going on in the training rooms and in the coaching organizations as to how players are being treated and the kind of opportunities they have to make their feelings known to the university. I think there should be a member of each sports team, a position created on each of the coaching staffs that is specifically focused on sexual assault, and that players should have meetings with them, you know, especially throughout the season, but also in the off season and in the summer, to make sure that they feel comfortable and that no more wrongdoings are being done here at MSU. If you'd like to call in and weigh in on the appointment of a new chief compliance officer at MSU, Nicholas Whitner, 517-355-9527 is the number to call. Let's take our first break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the NHL and possible super teams that are forming, you know, kind of like the Golden State Warriors in the NBA. You're listening to AM 870 and 105.1 FM. This is WKER. Welcome back to WKAR's Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley, filling in for Al Martin on this July 6th Friday. Al likes to call it Fry-yay. It's been a slow Friday for me. I'm still trying to wake up here, even though it is 1:26 in the afternoon. But we'll get it together here, and I'm sure you guys will help me get through it. We're going to talk NHL here. There's a debate going on among some analysts that we could be seeing a new era in the NHL, the era of the super team, something like the NBA has been experiencing recently with teams like the Golden State Warriors signing a wealth of talent. And here to talk with me about the NHL and its possible super teams is our engineer for the day, Jack Kerwin. Jack, looking at some of the moves that have been made so far in this NHL free agency period, which teams stand out in your mind right now as a possible super team candidate?
Well, I think it's really interesting, you know, seeing John Tavares make the move to the Toronto Maple Leafs. 27-year-old veteran, definitely the biggest free agency move, at least in the salary cap era in the NHL. You know, he's one of the top 10 players in all of hockey right now, I would say. And he's entering a situation where he might be his team's second-line center, depending on how, Coach Mike Babcock draws it up. But I think what's really interesting when you talk about super teams is Sean Simpson of TSN reported yesterday, this hasn't been confirmed yet, but that Erik Karlsson has been traded to the Tampa Bay Lightning. I think this is a really interesting move simply because, you know, you were talking about super teams. I don't think GM Steve Yzerman makes this move if Toronto doesn't acquire John Tavares last week. So you've kind of seen a lot of talent emerging in the Atlantic Division from these two teams specifically for the purpose of beating each other. And you have, when you look at the Toronto Maple Leafs, you certainly have two bona fide superstars in Austin Matthews and John Tavares now, and then some second tier stars as well with Mitch Marner, William Nylander, and Morgan Rielly. And the same can be said about the Tampa Bay Lightning. You know, you got two superstars, and then another. I would say Erik Karlsson and Steven Stamkos are definitely bona fide superstars, and you can make the argument Nikita Kucherov is as well. And then you have another bona fide number one defenseman in Victor Hedman, as well as other great support players like Tyler Johnson. So I think it's really interesting just kind of see, you know, I don't know if it's a super team the way it is in the NBA because you haven't seen a ton of free agents kind of linking up in a new city, but it's interesting to see where these two teams have gone especially and how other teams are going to react throughout the league.
So do you think that Montreal needed to make that move to secure John Tavares? Did they have a big need at center, or were they just looking to add more talent to their roster?
Toronto, you mean Toronto?
Toronto, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting because you can never have too many stars, obviously. I would say their biggest need was and still is defense, certainly. They have two very talented defensemen in Morgan Rielly and Jake Gardner, who both put up over 50 points last season. But, you know, they're thin on depth after that. You know, Morgan Rielly got hurt in Game 7, and Jake Gardner had to play, you know, number one defense minutes in Game 7, and he didn't look very good. But, you know what? I don't think it was necessarily their biggest need, but it's just a case of, when a player of John Tavares' caliber hits free agency and you're a contending team with cap space like the Toronto Maple Leafs are because they're so young, you find a way to bring the guy in and you kind of worry about needs later. You know what I mean? It's almost like when the Tigers brought in Prince Fielder a couple of years ago, didn't work out very well, obviously. But, you know, the idea was bring in another star and work out the rest of your needs later.
And again, with the Tampa Bay Lightning, so the move hasn't been confirmed yet for Erik Karlsson. But there are reports that they're at least negotiating a deal, correct?
Yeah, the report is I don't know if the deal's done, but the report is Erik Karlsson is heading to Tampa Bay.
Okay. So, again, you said this move was reactionary on the part of Tampa Bay. Does Karlsson fill any of their needs, or was it another move like Tavares where there's a huge free agent on the market, we're going to pick him up and kind of worry about the rest of our needs later?
You know what, I'll be honest with you, I don't think Tampa Bay has a ton of needs. You know what I mean? They just haven't won the Stanley Cup yet because it's so hard to win. You know, you've seen Alex Ovechkin, this was his 15th season or something, 14th season, I believe, in the NHL, and he finally won a Stanley Cup. I don't view the Tampa Bay Lightning as having any glaring holes on their roster, so for me, it's a great move. It's another superstar, and in my mind, he's the best defenseman in the NHL.
So now with the addition of Erik Karlsson to Tampa Bay, which team, in your mind, either between Toronto or Tampa Bay, has a better chance of winning the Stanley Cup this year?
So I said Toronto, what was it, Monday? Mm-hmm. I'm back on the Tampa Bay train. You know, we'll see. Maybe if Toronto can bring in, you know, Patrick Laine or someone else, maybe it'll be a little different. But for now, I'm back on Tampa Bay.
Well, there you go. How do you think that this reactionary move was necessary by Tampa Bay? Do you think that this will actually add anything to their roster, or are they just kind of stockpiling wealth at this point?
I mean, certainly reactionary, but at the same time, I think it's a very beneficial move. If you can find a way to fit a guy like Erik Karlsson onto your team when you already have a wealth of talent, you do it. And you know what? Here's the other thing. He's only got a year left on his deal, so it remains to be seen if they'll have enough money to re-sign him long-term. But you know, it kind of gives them a leg up on the competition that, first off, they'll be the only team that'll be able to offer him 8 years a year from now because he's on their team currently. And you know, they have a full, basically, calendar year to see if they can negotiate a deal. So they're kind of a step ahead of the rest of the league in terms of Erik Karlsson's free agency next season.
Now with the with these two teams kind of ramping it up here in free agency, how can other teams compete with the wealth of talent that they've assembled?
You know, it's going to be tough, but here's something that I think is interesting. You know, a lot of teams may not necessarily have to, because Toronto and Tampa Bay are both in the same division. And I would make the argument now that the Atlantic Division in the Eastern Conference is certainly the toughest division in the NHL. You know, you got teams in the Western Conference and the Central Division, like the Winnipeg Jets and the Nashville Predators. They kind of, you know, they're each other's competition, if you will. You know, those are probably the two best teams in that division. But after that, there's not a ton of talent that they have to get through. You know, St. Louis is a decent team. You know, team like Chicago could be back in the mix. But you know, certainly in the Western Conference, they may not necessarily need to gear up on superstars to be able to make a playoff run, just because they'll have an easier road. So I think it's interesting that these two teams are in the same division, because especially in hockey, where anything can happen, teams may not necessarily need to spend big or make a blockbuster trade to bring in another superstar, because they might have an easier road to the Stanley Cup final.
So you think some players will be enticed by the easier schedule in certain respects?
You know what, that's an interesting point, but I was speaking more from the perspective of GMs. You know, if I'm a GM in the Western Conference, in the Pacific Division especially, which is a tough example because there aren't any really great teams in my mind other than, you know, we'll see what happens with Vegas next season. But I'm not necessarily, you know, super nervous about these moves, just because if I'm facing a Tampa or a Toronto, it won't be until the Stanley Cup final. So, and at that point, anything can happen, you know, especially in hockey. All it takes, you got to win 4-7, and puck luck and goaltending can get you a win and put you on a run. So I don't know if it really would have a huge effect on the Western Conference and even the Metro Division in the East.
So let's localize this a little bit. How do you think the Red Wings stack up now that they've made some of these new free agency moves? I mean, we talked about the Athanasiou signing today. They've made a couple of other good offseason moves here in free agency so far. How far are the Red Wings from, you know, at least competing again in the playoffs?
Well, that's kind of my next point. These two teams being in the same division as the Detroit Red Wings does not help the Wings at all. And, you know, Rasmus Dahlin, the first overall pick going to Buffalo in the draft a week ago, you know, you see the Atlantic Division just gearing up on talent, not to mention, you know, a great team like Boston who took out Toronto in 7 games last season. You know, there's in the playoffs, that is, you know, there's a wealth of talent in our division, and the Red Wings just, you know, for lack of a better term, they're just kind of complacent. I wasn't a huge fan of either of their free agency moves in terms of bringing back Mike Green or bringing back Thomas Vanek, for that matter. So I don't think the Red Wings are particularly close. The best thing that could happen to the Red Wings next season would be to win the draft lottery and to get Jack Hughes, who's going to be a pretty special player moving forward. He's slotted to be the first overall pick in next year's draft. But the Red Wings are going to need some lottery luck in order to be able to compete in this division.
Is there a mentality in the NHL, like with some teams in the NBA, where tanking during the regular season is considered by, you know, either coaches or GMs?
Oh, absolutely. That's how Toronto got Austin Matthews a couple years ago. And you know what? You've seen teams rebuild more aggressively the last couple years. And that's kind of me as a Red Wings fan, what I've been pushing the Red Wings to do. And they've done a little bit of it, you know, trading Thomas Tatar for a first, second, and third round pick with Vegas. You know, I think they probably would have traded Mike Green at the deadline had he not had a neck injury. But yeah, absolutely. And I think it's tough to maintain a winning culture when you're losing for a number of years, and you have to get lucky to an extent because you still need to win the lottery, and in the year that you win the lottery, there needs to be a special player in that draft. But I think it's a very, very viable strategy to win.
Let's talk about some of the other teams that are perennial cup contenders, like the Pittsburgh Penguins, for example. With these new moves that Montreal and Tampa Bay have made, are they how wide is the gap between the teams at the top and kind of the second tier of competition in the NHL?
Well, I don't know if I'd call the Pittsburgh Penguins the second tier of the NHL, just because, you know what, they have a championship pedigree. You know, they just won back-to-back cups in, what was it, 2016 and 2017. The issue for them is, you know, their stars are aging a little bit more now. You know, Crosby's going to be, I don't know, 31, 32, same with Evgeny Malkin. So that would be my only concern for the Pittsburgh Penguins. And I think fatigue was a very real factor for them in their series with Washington last season. So I don't know if in terms of star power they're lacking compared to the Toronto Maple Leafs or the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's just for me age and a lot of miles on their best players' bodies, you know?
Mm-hmm. And two of the more intriguing teams to me over the past, I would say, five seasons have been the Nashville Predators and then obviously the Vegas Golden Knights. Nashville had a surprising run in the playoffs a couple years ago for many and actually made it to the Stanley Cup Finals. But it seems like they've kind of fallen off a little bit over the past season or so. How can they kind of work their way back up into the top tier of the NHL?
Well, kind of a similar situation for Nashville. That's an interesting point because the way Nashville has found success in the playoffs has been having a really strong top four defensive core. So I would argue before, you know, the trade that has been reportedly made for the Lightning to land Erik Karlsson, the first pairing of PK Subban and Roman Josi in Nashville is probably the best D pair in all of hockey. And then you follow that up with, you know, a second pair of Matthias Ekholm and Ryan Ellis. You know, that's how they have success. They consist of a top four defensive core that they're very sound in their own end, and they're very good at generating offense. So that even though Nashville doesn't necessarily have a ton of, I guess, household names up front, you know, Philip Forsberg's a star, and I think Victor Arvidsson's one of the most underrated players in the NHL. You know, they're able to win with defense and great goaltending as well. But that's going to be a question for Nashville moving forward, just because Pekka was 35 this past season. And, you know, he's a Hall of Fame goalie, finally won his first Vezina trophy last season for the best goalie in the NHL. But, you know, goaltending especially is where my questions, where I'll begin to question the Nashville Predators, just because, you know, Pekka is not as young as he used to be. And the Vegas Golden Knights, that's an interesting question just because they were such an enigma last year. You know, nobody expected Vegas to be good, and when you looked at their roster, you know, you didn't expect them to be good. But you had several players who outperformed, you know, their previous, what we thought to be their capabilities. And it was a team full of players who did this, you know, Alex Tuch and Nate Schmidt. And then you add in a Hall of Fame goaltender like Marc-Andre Fleury. It'll be interesting to see if that was really just lightning in a bottle last year or if the Vegas Golden Knights are for real.
So now that Toronto and Tampa Bay are kind of stepping it up, do you think that that division is the division to beat in the NHL?
The Atlantic Division?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, without a doubt.
Okay. Well, I think we'll take our second break here. When we come back, we'll talk a little baseball, specifically where the Tigers stand right now in the ranks of the MLB. And we'll talk about kind of where every team is shaping up right now as we're heading towards the All-Star break. You're listening to AM 870 and 105.1 FM WKAR. Welcome back to WKAR's Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley, filling in for Al Martin on this Friday afternoon. Just finished up our conversation about the NFL or the NHL and some super teams that are taking shape in the Atlantic Division. If you'd like to call in and give your thoughts on that or any of the other topics we've discussed today, 517-355-9527 is the number to call. Now let's take a look at the MLB. There are some intriguing pennant races shaping up. Specifically, the AL East is looking nice. the Yankees are one of the teams that intrigue me the most right now in baseball, as well as the Boston Red Sox and the Cleveland Indians. The AL Central is the one division race that isn't really close. The Cleveland Indians seem like far and away the best team in that division. And they need to get Andrew Miller healthy to help out a bullpen that ranks 28th in the majors. That's really one of Cleveland's only weaknesses. Also needs to figure out their center field issues, where three players have started 20-plus games but have combined for the second lowest WOBA in the majors with minus one defensive runs saved. Again, not a very good stat for the Cleveland Indians, but they really don't have a whole lot of other holes necessarily in their roster. Is SB voting going on soon? Best MLB player Aaron Judge from the New York Yankees is up for that. Jose Altuve for the Houston Astros is also a candidate. Mike Trout for the Los Angeles Angels and Max Scherzer for the Washington Nationals round out the list of voting for the best MLB players. And to me, Aaron Judge has actually, I don't know if he's necessarily replicated the same production that we've seen from him last season. Seems like a little bit of the hype is dying down around him. All of these players are fantastic. You know, they're going to give you their best, and it's going to be better than what most other players in the MLB can give you on a game-to-game basis. But Max Scherzer really sticks out in my mind as the candidate right now, at least, for the best player in the MLB. He's been fantastic as the Washington Nationals ace over the past few seasons, ever since he sadly got traded from the Detroit Tigers. But hey, what else is new? A former Tiger going on and doing fantastic things at their new team. One of the big questions right now in the MLB is, can the Seattle Mariners hang with the Houston Astros? Probably not, even though they begin the week just a half a game behind Houston. The Mariners are 8-0 in extra innings and 26-11 in one-run games. The Astros have a couple of interesting issues. Will they work their top two prospects, outfielder Kyle Tucker and pitcher Forrest Whitley, into the mix? Tucker's been pretty good in AAA, while Whitley could be a bullpen weapon down the stretch. Also, is Hector Rondon the final solution at closer? The much-maligned Houston bullpen, by the way, has a 1.85 ERA since June 1st, with 113 Ks in 82 and two-thirds innings. For the Mariners, how will they integrate Robinson Cano back into the lineup when he finally comes off of his suspension on August 14th? They've been a better defensive team with D. Gordon at second and not in center, but they could use Cano's bat, which might mean Gordon back in center, at least on a part-time basis. They're also on the lookout for a starter. Given the terrible state of their farm system, Cole Hamels is a possibility, as they might not have to do too much except pick up his salary, and Seattle is not on Hamels' no-trade list. The Braves and the Phillies have shown they have enough staying power to scare the Washington Nationals. Both teams also have similar needs. Manny Machado would be a fit for both lineups, and both teams need bullpen help. The Braves are 2-7 in extra innings and rank 16th in bullpen win probability, while the Phillies rank 13th. Both pens have struggled since June 1st, however, with the Phillies 27th in the majors with a 5.33 ERA and the Braves at 29th at 5.55 ERA in that span. Every contender will want Brad Hand if the Padres do decide to deal him, and both of these teams should make a strong pitch to get him. Without a powerhouse team in the National League, this is a perfect season for the Milwaukee Brewers to make a big deadline splash. Jacob DeGrom has been a target that people have talked about for the Brewers, and Brewers fans on Twitter were actually opposed to the idea, which was kind of surprising. The offense does need help as well, but Brad Miller is probably not the solution for them at shortstop. Maybe they'll live with defensive shortcomings and look to add a second baseman such as Asdrubal Cabrera. Fangraphs still see the Dodgers as the favorite in the NL West, but projects them with just 89 wins, the Diamondbacks with 87 victories, and the Giants with 82. The Giants went 18-10 in June and won their first game of July. And while they're not completely healthy, with Evan Longoria, Johnny Cueto, and Jeff Samardzija, remain on the disabled list, they look more like a threat than they did a month ago. They've played the Diamondbacks 12 times and the Dodgers 13 times, and the Dodgers have played the Diamondbacks 12 times. So there aren't many head-to-head showdowns remaining among the three teams. The Giants do finish up with a series against the Dodgers. Maybe it will mean something. I mean, maybe we'll even get a three-way tie for the division title out there in the NL West. That would be pretty interesting as well. The Tigers not doing so hot, to say the least, right now. They broke an 11-game losing streak recently, but they've taken a couple losses against the Texas Rangers as well now in this series. Most recently, the loss yesterday, which I believe was a 7-5 loss. Matthew Boyd did not look good in that game. He's had an up-and-down season so far this year. He gave up 6 earned runs in 4 innings. But the bullpen actually did surprise a lot of people yesterday. 5 scoreless, 1-hit innings to give the Tigers offense a chance. And the Tigers offense was actually taking advantage of that chance. They fought tooth and nail, scoring 5 runs in the last few innings. And there was a time where I thought they were going to try and or going to be able to tie it up. But they now fall to 38-51 on the season. And they've slipped out of the AL Central race, which, again, is led by the far superior Cleveland Indians. Jack Kerwin, how do you feel about some of the races shaping up here in the MLB, and how do the Tigers kind of bounce back from the losses that they've been taking recently and some of the poor bullpen performances? Is there any way back into this AL Central race for them, or are the Cleveland Indians just far and away gonna run away with this thing?
Certainly not. No chance. They're 12 games out, right around the midway point of the season. Looks like they're actually a little bit past the midway point, you know, about 90 games in. So, no, absolutely not. I mean, trust the process. That's my motto for the Tigers right about now. And I'm looking towards the future. And I don't even have a whole lot to be excited about, you know, with the Tigers until we see what they do at the deadline. And then, you know, young players like the Franklin Perez's and the Matt Mannings and the Alex Fiedos and the Dowell Lugo to a lesser extent, Daz Cameron's, guys like that come up and start to play with the big club, and we can kind of see what they do, what they can do. As far as the division races around the league, you know, par for the course, the AL East is obviously just one of the most exciting, one of the most interesting storylines because you have two powerhouses in the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees. I happen to like the Yankees a little bit better there. You know, as you pointed out, the AL Central is really the only one that isn't close. The Cleveland Indians are running away with it. And even so, they're not super impressive. Just looking at the standings right here, the Boston Red Sox are 59-29. You know, the Indians are, what, 11 games below that? They're 48-37. So, you know, it's interesting just to see just really how awful the AL Central is. But you summed it up really well with the National League. I don't see a team that really stands out to me as a powerhouse. You know, you got the Los Angeles Dodgers who spend big every year and kind of like the Tigers, just really don't have much to show for it. Chicago Cubs obviously won a couple of years ago, and although they're a game and a half back right now in the Central, they're certainly a team to watch. Championship pedigree, young team. You know, they really seem to have everything going. Their only shortcomings are, you know, Kyle Hendricks has struggled this year, obviously, and, you know, their pitching in general, whether it be the bullpen or their starting rotation, is not quite as good as it could be, but that'll be an interesting storyline to watch as well. But for the Tigers, I don't see any way back for them this season.
Actually, Detroit Tigers prospects Matt Manning and Dowell Lugo, who you mentioned just a second ago, something to focus on other than the dreadful season that we're having. They'll both be playing in the All-Star Futures game on July 15th at Nationals Park in Washington, D.C. Manning will be on the United States team, and Lugo, who is from the Dominican Republic, will be on the international team, and that game will take place at 4 p.m. on July 15th. The Futures game precedes the Home Run Derby, which is July 16th at 8 p.m. on ESPN, and the MLB All-Star game, which is on July 17th at 7:30 p.m. on Fox. Manning has appeared in 11 games for the single-A West Michigan Whitecaps in the Midwest League. I actually saw him play the other day. I was home with my family in Mount Pleasant, and we went over to a Great Lakes Loons game, and they played the Whitecaps. He actually looked sensational in that game, so good news if you're a Tigers fan. And one for the Lakeland Flying Tigers in the Florida State League before being traded to the Whitecaps. He played one game there as well. Combined, he is 4-3 with a 3.12 ERA and 1.29 WHIP, with 85 strikeouts and 48 hits over 60.2 innings. Now, Dowell Lugo, who is 23, has played in 78 games for the AAA Toledo Mudhens this season. He is hitting .273 with 19 doubles and 34 RBIs in 330 at-bats. So again, another exciting prospect if you're a Tigers fan. Manning was drafted by the Tigers in the first round of 2016, and Lugo was acquired in the deal that sent J.D. Martinez to the Arizona Diamondbacks last season. So again, something to look forward to, but it doesn't look like they'll be helping out these Detroit Tigers this season at the very least. Well, it's almost the end of the week here, and almost the end of our show here on Current Sports. So I'm going to do Reflection Friday, but I'm going to do it a little bit differently than maybe Al Martin would do it. Normally, we just focus on our favorite moments of the week in sports, and we'll get to that. But first, I want to do my own little reflection on kind of some of the lessons that we can take away from sports, kind of a bigger picture type thing. You know, one of the great things about sports is the camaraderie that you get from being part of a team, or, you know, kind of the confidence booster that you get from participating in an athletic event. And when you succeed, it's a fantastic feeling. But when you lose, it can be very detrimental to, you know, the way that you view yourself or the way you view others on your team. But the one thing I want to stress with sports, and I think the thing that we can all take away from sports as a whole, is the amount of respect that there is between players from different teams, players from different walks of life, players from different financial situations. I think the one thing that is really stressed through sports is not only the respect for yourself, but the respect for others. When I was graduating high school and about to make my way here to Michigan State, my dad actually sat me down and we had a conversation about respect. And he said, "Son, the one thing that I want you to take with you throughout your life is that no matter how bad people treat you or how much they wrong you or, you know, how much they hurt you, the one thing that you have to do above all else is still respect that other person. You know, it's important to take the time to place yourself in other people's shoes and look at things from their point of view. And that will really benefit you as well, moving forward in your own life, to kind of take the experiences of others and try and incorporate them into your own life." And that's something that's really stuck with me throughout my career here at MSU and in my travels and my study abroads, is just to take the time to sit down with others and, you know, form a real human connection with someone else and try and look at things through their point of view. You know, maybe issues that are important to me can affect someone else in a different way. And I think sports is one of those nice things in our society that allows us to really see that in action, whether it be players taking a knee for the national anthem, or, you know, there's the famous picture from the Olympics in 78, I believe, in Mexico City, where two track athletes on the podium raised their fists in solidarity with other members of the African-American community back in the United States, letting them know that even though they were still at the Olympics and out of the country, that their hearts and their minds were with the other people back at home who were suffering or didn't have the opportunity to, you know, have that wonderful experience of competing in the Olympics. So respect is the name of the game in sports. You know, you see it at the end of every game. There's a handshake involved between both teams, or, you know, kind of a slap on the butt saying good game. And I think, you know, we've been talking about hockey a lot today. Hockey is a great example of, you know, we're enemies on the ice and I'm going to do my best to rough you up, but afterwards it's just back to being normal people and we can go grab a beer and talk about life. I think sports allows us the opportunity to reflect on some of our own personal issues through the eyes of others and the insights that some of these athletes have tried to give through their own struggles. And I just think that if you do your best to not only respect yourself, but respect other people, that your life will improve drastically, your outlook on life will improve drastically, and people's opinions of you will be nothing but high esteem and high regard. We're about out of time here on WKAR's Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley. I've been filling in for Al Martin all this week here on AM 870 and 105.1 FM. Still can't get that right, you know? We've gone all show and I've messed that up like three times, but that's okay. 105.1 FM, AM 870. Thank you for tuning in. If you listened on WKAR.org or on my Facebook live stream, again, thank you for tuning in. I appreciate all your support. We're on a weekend-long break, but we'll be back on Monday with your regularly scheduled programming and our fantastic host, Al Martin. I've really enjoyed this week being here with you and getting the opportunity to discuss some of the big issues and the big news in sports. Thank you to my wonderful production assistants, Jack Kerwin and Alec Rio, Connor Mathis, and Tamar Davis for all the help that they've given me this week. Take care, be safe this weekend. Don't do anything I wouldn't do. And be easy, people.